We return now to our studies in 1 Corinthians. This church, which was in so much like American churches, I think no American Christian can read 1 Corinthians without feeling right at home. I was told recently of a young pastor who was inquiring of an older pastor what he should do in terms of preparation for his ministry. And the older man said to him, "Well, I would advise that above all else you must get a PhD degree. For," he said, "no church will listen today to a man who does not have a PhD degree." And when I heard that, the centuries fell away and I felt I was right back in Corinth with its love of human wisdom, its exaltation of human philosophies, and its stress upon status symbols, which was dividing the church and producing factions and schisms and quarrelings in their midst. These Christians at Corinth were quarreling over what Paul calls the wisdom of words. And their quarrelings and their divisions were sabotaging the impact of this church upon the city, so that much of what had started out with tremendous power in the city of Corinth was beginning to fade away because of the division within the congregation. Now, the cure to such divisiveness and dissension, Paul says, is the gospel. We usually think of the gospel as something that non-Christians need to hear. But the New Testament makes very clear to us that it's Christians who need to understand the gospel. Because it's not only the means by which you become a Christian, to believe the gospel, but it's the means by which you are delivered in your Christian life from all the causes of disagreements and dissensions and factions and from the pressures of lusts and so forth in the Christian life. Now, the heart of the gospel, Paul says, is the cross of Jesus Christ. And he brings us to that in the 17th verse of the first chapter, where he says, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, and not with eloquent wisdom," that is, wisdom of words, "lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power." The theme of this next section is the power of the cross. And Paul is going to show us very clearly here, in a very profound passage, what the cross does in human thinking and in human affairs. The cross, of course, has become the symbol of Christianity today. We have one right behind me here. You see it in almost every place. Ladies wear it on chains around their neck. We use it as decorations in various places. And we've become so familiar with the cross in those terms that we've forgotten, I think, much of the impact that the cross had in the first century. It was for these early Christians and for those among whom they lived a symbol of something horrible. If you used a cross as a symbol then, it made people shudder. I think we'd get very much closer to it today if we'd substitute a little symbol of an electric chair for the cross. Supposing we had an electric chair mounted on our wall with its straps and its atmosphere of death and of shame. Wouldn't it be strange driving across this country to see church steeples with electric chairs at the top? And though we might think it strange, we'd get much closer to the meaning that the cross had in the minds and thinkings of the first century people, if that were true. Now, the cross is not the whole of the gospel. Some people have misunderstood that from this letter of Paul's, because he says that when he came to Corinth, he came determined not to preach anything among them save Jesus Christ and Him crucified. But that doesn't mean that the cross is the only part of the gospel, because before this letter is over, the apostle is going to spend a great section on the resurrection of Christ. That's part of it too. But the cross was particularly needed here in Corinth, as it is needed in our American churches, because the word of the cross is the answer and the cure to all human division. And that's what was troubling that church. Now, Paul goes on to introduce this in verse 18. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart. Here we have an introduction to the astonishing power of the cross. The cross is significant in Christianity because it exposes the fundamental conflict of life. That's what these verses declare to us. It gets down below all our surface attempts at compromise and cuts down to the basic difference behind all human disagreement. Cuts right through to bedrock and exposes the basic commitment of every human soul to either error or to truth. And once you confront the cross and its meaning, you find yourself unable to escape that final basic judgment of life as to whether you are committed to error or you're committed to truth. Now, we must understand, before we go on, very clearly what he means by the word of the cross. First of all, of course, it means the basic announcement of the crucifixion of Jesus. The cross was a fact of history. Any of you who have been involved in some of the modern cults that are springing up, or some of the psychological groupies that are forming today, emphasizing meditation or transactional analysis or something of this sort, know that what you are introduced to in these groups is basically philosophy. Various ideas that men have about human behavior and how to control it. And there are conflicting philosophies in this area today. And some will follow one school and some will follow another. And you get a whole range, a whole spectrum of religious groups based upon various philosophical concepts. But when you come to Christianity, you don't start with philosophy. You start with facts. Inescapable facts of history that can't be thrown out or avoided. They're there. One of them is the incarnation of Jesus. The fact that he came among us, was born as a man, and yet under strange and marvelous circumstances. Another of the great facts of our faith is the crucifixion. He died. He was nailed to a tree. It was done at a certain point in time in history, and it cannot be evaded. And this is part of the word of the cross. It's the part of the gospel that we declare to men everywhere, that something happened to Jesus of Nazareth that was very strange. He died a strange death. He didn't deserve it. But by the judgment of the Romans and the Jews alike, he was put to death for a crime that he did not do. Now, that's part of the word of the cross. But that, of course, is not all of it. What is meant by this phrase primarily is a reference to the judgment that the cross makes upon human life. That's where we run into what Paul calls later the offense of the cross. You see, When you say that Jesus was crucified, you're saying that when even the best of men, the very universally acknowledged finest man who ever lived, takes the place of any one of us, or any person anywhere in the world who has ever lived, when the best of men takes our place, he deserves nothing but the instant judgment of God and death at God's hand. And you see, that's a judgment on all of us. That's what people don't like about the cross. It condemns our righteousnesses. It casts aspersion on all our good efforts and wipes it all out and says it's worthless, useless, totally worthless. What the cross therefore says is that no human effort apart from God is worth the snap of your fingers. And that we don't like. Man with God, the scriptures say, is worth more than the whole universe combined. A single individual yielding to the God who made him and filled with the power of God designed for him is worth far more than all the created universe beside. But man without God is a totally worthless being whose only value lies in the possibility that divine life can be reinstated and restored to him. Now that's the word of the cross. That's what Paul means when he speaks of this, of the cross as the symbol of Christian life. Now he goes on in this verse to tell us that that word therefore always produces two reactions. It did in the first century and it still does today, exactly the same two. In the first place, the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. And the word folly here means literally silly. It's silliness. It's absurdity. It's nonsense to those who are perishing. If you've ever tried to witness to somebody who has a sense of sufficiency about himself, who feels that he's a self-made man, And he worships his Creator, you have discovered the folly of the cross. To come and tell such a man that all his efforts and all his record, his impressive record of achievement, is worth nothing in God's sight. It doesn't make him one degree more acceptable. It is nothing but essentially a wasted effort. You're going to immediately run into the offense of the cross. He's going to call that silly. That doctrine is absurd. You mean to tell me that all this impressive array of human knowledge and wisdom that has been accumulated for centuries with all the great achievements of mankind in the realm of the relief of human misery, the technological advances of our day, that all that is absolutely worthless? Nonsense. That's what they said in the first century. That's what they still say today. And I'm sure there are some here this morning that are thinking that. If that's what the Bible teaches, then I think it's ridiculous to wipe that all out. The other reaction is to those of us who are being saved. See, the perishing have not perished yet. They're on the way to perishing. Nor have the saved been fully saved yet. We're on the way to that final salvation yet to be realized. But to us who are being saved, the cross is the power of God. It's the key to the release of all God's blessing in human life. It's the way to experience the healing of God in the heart, the deliverance from the reign of sin, and to lead into wholeness and peace and joy. And the cross is an inescapable part of that process. Now, those are the two reactions. And to prove that this is universally the case, not something just for a moment in time, but always God's way with man, Paul quotes the prophet Isaiah, where Isaiah had said that God speaks, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart." If you look that up in the book of Isaiah, you'll find that that came at a time when Israel, or when Judah, was being confronted with an impossible invasion on the north. The northern borders of the land were surrounded or were attacked by the Assyrian army. And all the statesmen of the day and the politicians, including King Hezekiah, were trying to find a way out of this dilemma. It reads very much like the present-day crisis in the Mideast today. They were trying to find a way by human ingenuity and political scheming to either make a treaty with Egypt or a mutual defense pact and thus escape it, or somehow turn off the wrath of the Assyrian army and escape imminent invasion. And then God spoke through the prophet Isaiah and announced that he would deliver his people, and he didn't need any help from the politicians. And this is the way he put it: "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart." And the book of Isaiah goes on to record how God did that very thing. That when the Assyrian army came on, it came right up to the very gates of Jerusalem. It spread itself around the city. And the king, looking out, could see the hordes of Assyrian army out there, their tents surrounding the whole city, and the cause looked absolutely hopeless. And the Assyrians were mocking and taunting the Israelites. And the leader, Sennacherib, sent a letter into the king ordering him to surrender. And the king took it and spread it out before the Lord and prayed over it. A beautiful record there in the 38th, 39th chapters of Isaiah. And God answered. And overnight he delivered the land. He sent an angel who in one night slew 185,000 of the Assyrian soldiers. History says it was a plague that broke out in the Assyrian camp, and overnight 185,000 of them were dead. The Authorized Version puts it in a rather remarkable way. It says, "When they woke up in the morning, behold, they were all dead." And God did exactly what he said. He didn't ask for any human help at all. He just did it. And the land was delivered. Now, Paul picks that up and he says that's the way God works. Especially does he work that way in the matter of human redemption. And that brings us then to his analysis and the direct examination of the wisdom of the world of this age versus the wisdom of God, beginning with verse 20. Now, the verses we're going to look at is a very profound passage. And I want to just take our time with it, and we'll only cover a few, very few verses of it this morning. Because it's one of the most amazing examinations of a problem that every generation without fail has to face. That is, how much shall I trust the wisdom of men? How much reliance should we put upon the ability of men to solve their own problems in whatever realm or dimension of life you care to investigate? This is particularly a helpful passage to students at school, whoever it may be. What Paul says is this, verse 20, "Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Or since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. You notice that begins with three questions. But you're essentially asking this one question. What true standing does human wisdom give to you? Here we come up against the matter of how much value really are degrees. I'm not setting aside degrees. They do represent something of value. But how much of a human life and the value of a life can be detected by the degrees that a man has? That's part of this question. What standing does human wisdom truly give you? And the implication of these questions is none. Where is the wise man, Paul says? Where really is he? Where is the scribe of this age? The debater of this age? Now, in using those words, he's referring to the two universal approaches to understanding and gathering knowledge and wisdom. The first is the scribal approach. That's the Jewish approach. It is a study of the past. All the wisdom of the ages, the writings of the past. The Jewish scribes gave their whole attention to reading the ancient scriptures and the ancient writings of wise men of the past and trying to gather it all and reduce it to practical applications for today. That was the scribe approach. And Paul says, where does that get you? The answer is nowhere. Well, what about the debater, he says, of this age? That was the Greek approach. The Greeks loved to get together in the marketplaces and debate the philosophies of today. We would call it the dialectic approach. Arguing as to which is better, which is right, and debating all the conflicting philosophies and opinions of the day. And Paul is raising the question, where does that get you? And again, the implied answer is clearly nowhere. What is it worth? Nothing. Now, that's a very harsh judgment, isn't it? And I think at this point we must make a very important distinction. There's a difference between human knowledge and human wisdom. And unfortunately, in reading a passage like this, many confuse the two. Knowledge is the discovery of truth. And God always encourages it. He gave us minds to use. And there's nothing anti-intellectual in the Scriptures. I want to make that very clear. God has set man on a search to unravel and discover the secrets he has hidden in the universe. And there are thousands of them, millions of them. Many the greatest, I'm sure, yet undiscovered. And man is given the gift of wisdom, of reason, to search these out and to investigate into any realm of knowledge is perfectly right and proper. To give yourself to a discovery of physics and the laws of physics and what's behind matter is perfectly right. To give yourself to an investigation of the wonders of the human body and the way of treatment in medicine and pathology is perfectly right. To set yourself to discover the secrets of the stars, of astronomy, or the secrets of the workings of the human mind and the psyche in psychology, these are all perfectly right. Nothing wrong with it at all. Scripture always encourages us to look at that. But that's knowledge. That's the discovery of truth. Wisdom is the use of truth. And there's where Scripture always throws down the gauntlet. It says there's something faulted about human wisdom. It does not know how to use truth. All the knowledge that is All the truth that's discovered through human knowledge is misused. It's abused. It's twisted. It's distorted. And we end up, therefore, worse off than we were before. Now, I think this needs to be said today in a university community such as we have right here. And it needs to be especially emphasized because so many Christians begin to worship human wisdom and to feel that secular writers know more about some of these matters applying to the use of knowledge than Christians do. Now, there's no question but what many secular writers know a far great degree more about the discovery of truth than many, many Christians do. We can learn tremendous things from the secular world around us. But what we must clearly understand, and what this great passage will help us to understand, is when it comes to the applying of truth, secular minds are juvenile in their applications, for the most part. They're twisted, and they don't know what to do with it. And so are a lot of Christians who follow along these same paths, who have not approached it, the use of truth, from the wisdom and the revelation of the Word of God. And that needs very strongly to be said. It's amazing that even thoughtful secular writers will distinguish these differences and see this. I was just reading recently an excerpt from Vance Packard's new book, The People Shapers, in which he's exploring the possibilities of molding the minds of men and altering human behavior by scientific processes. And he concludes the article with these words: "A person can be high in learning ability and memory and still remain a fool." Those aren't my words. Those are Vance Packard's. He says, "The two do not add up to either brilliance of or wisdom in thinking. Until someone comes along with a pill for wisdom, we might better aspire to become a more humane society rather than a more brainy one." Vance Packard. Now in verse 20, the apostle also asks another question. He says, "Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" And when he says that, he is declaring, in essence, he's asking the question, what is the true nature of human wisdom? And his answer is foolishness. It's ridiculous. It sounds impressive, and it always does. It radiates optimism. It even seems to work for a while in a limited area of application. This is what always confuses us so. But when it's all over, it has succeeded in changing nothing. Now that we need to face. That's a fact. That's why every generation wrestles with the same problems that the previous generations have wrestled with. And that remains true as far back as you go into the farthest reaches of human history. Same old problem. That's why we're confronted with a puzzle of why one generation never seems to learn from another. The great German philosopher Hegel was quite right when he said, "History teaches us that history teaches us nothing." That's why we who grow older and our vastly accumulated wisdom shake our heads in wonderment at the present generation coming up into their 20s and say, "How come they're making the same mistakes we made? Don't they ever learn? Won't they ever listen?" That's why old age always points to young age and says, "Won't you listen? Won't you pay attention?" And youth invariably points back and says, "Look what it made us. What were you got us? We're not going to pay any attention to you." And so they continually make the same mistakes over and over again. And that is the story of history. Winston Churchill said before he died these remarkable words, "Certain it is that while men are gathering knowledge and power with ever-increasing speed, their virtues and their wisdom have not shown any notable improvement as the centuries have rolled. Under sufficient stress, starvation, terror, warlike passion, or even cold intellectual frenzy, the modern man we know so well will do the most terrible deeds, and his modern woman will back him up." Winston Churchill. Well, now, why is this true? In verse 21, the apostle puts his finger right on the problem. "For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom." That's the problem. What's the major fault with the wisdom of man? Well, despite his pretentious claims to have penetrated the secrets of life, he has failed to discover and acknowledge the greatest fact of all, God Himself. The great being behind all that exists is God. And to ignore and to leave out of his thinking the most important fact of all is nothing but stupidity, isn't it? That's why in our public school systems there is a conspiracy of silence to keep God out. You run into it everywhere, don't you? No one dares to mention his name, hardly. Teachers are very careful not to allow the investigation of natural phenomena to lead to any conclusion that behind it is a being of great wisdom and power and might. They use euphemisms instead. Nature does this. Karma does this. Destiny. Fate. So on. Providence, if they're driven into a corner. But not God. Now that is another incredible fact, that all the investigation of the reasoning of the mind of man, he fails to discover the great force behind all matter, the great being behind all psychology, the great reality behind all the appearances that we investigate. And man, with all his brilliance, ends up like little children who fail to see a great giant towering in their midst because they're so happily engaged in swinging on his shoestrings. No wonder T.S. Eliot says, "All our knowledge only brings us closer to our ignorance, and all our ignorance closer to death. But closeness to death no nearer to God." Then he asks the question that hangs over this whole generation. Where is the life we have lost in living? Now what's God's answer to this? Well, Paul gives it to us now in verse 21. "It pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." What a strange answer that is. God has chosen to set aside both the searchings of men and the demands of men and to confront them with what is basically a simple story of a crucified Messiah. To proud, stubborn men who demand miracles or else they won't believe. We just had a clear example of that recently in the newspaper reports of the discovery of a shroud that is supposedly the burial shroud around Jesus that is marked with the image of a man. And it evokes tremendous popular attention immediately. Why? Because something about us wants to demand that God perform a miracle or else we won't believe. And we're right back to where the citizens of Nazareth were when Jesus came among them. And they asked him to do a sign and he would not do it because of their unbelief. And God wipes out that. To the proud men who demand miracles and to the foolish intellectuals who insist on an explanation or else they won't believe, God gives the same answer. The story of a crucified Messiah is held out to them as their only hope, for deliverance. And it's preached by the same kind of men and women as they themselves are. Not brilliant people, not great trained minds, not deep thinking philosophers, but common, ordinary citizens, housewives, slaves, artisans, craftsmen, whoever, whatever, anybody can preach the story of a crucified Messiah, and yet that story, believed in, effectively accomplishes what the wisdom of man and the power of man cannot do. Salvation. People are actually delivered from themselves. We all remember the close of the 60s when this whole nation was in the grip of a terrible wave after wave of violence that swept across our campuses and in our city streets. And the great racial unrest of that time, the violence that broke out between black and white. We all remember reading about an eloquent young black radical named Eldridge Cleaver that made white people tremble and sleep uneasily at night. And nobody knew what to do with him. The law couldn't handle him. All they could do was put him in prison if they could catch him. No philosophy seemed to reach him. Nothing could change him. All the education he'd had at American public schools and so on had not altered him. But we know how in God's wisdom and God's grace, at the right moment in his life, the word of the cross reached him. And he saw himself for what he was, without hope or help before God, except in Jesus Christ, and how that delivered him and changed him. And now he's living among us. Absolutely transformed, a positive force for good, where once he had been a powerful force to destroy. That's a demonstration in our own day, isn't it, of the power of the cross to effect what the wisdom of man cannot do. We all recall the mess of Watergate and the discovery, the sickening discovery of a basic illness so deeply involved in our whole national life that it touched the highest office in the land. And associated with it was an arrogant, ruthless young lawyer named Charles Colson. Now we have the story of how the word of the cross reached the hatchet man of the Nixon administration. And he's now devoting his life to the rescue of men in prison, changed by the power of God. More recently, we have the picture of the king of porn, Larry Flynt, editor of Hustler magazine, the raunchiest, dirtiest, most obscene of all the obscene magazines on the market today. And now he's changed, according to the reports, born again. Magazine's beginning to change because of the change in his life. But God has wrought by the power of the word of the cross. I just love to dwell on this because I think Christians have forgotten what God has put in our hands. What a marvelous God this is. Paul seems to bow in verse 25 to bow before the wonder and majesty an astonishment of this astonishing God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God, the nonsense of God, is stronger than men. And what man cannot do, God accomplishes it by this simple word about the crucifixion of Jesus and the judgment on the wisdom of man. I hope one effect of it will be in our own lives, that we not only understand the greatness of the God with whom we deal, but we understand the foolishness of the wisdom of the world. And that we understand that it cannot hold a candle to the greatness of the revelation of the truth of God. And when we open this book and study it and learn what God says about what life is, we're dealing with a reality that breaks away and strips off the illusions and the delusions of a secular age and introduces us to bedrock reality. That's where we ought to live. I want to close this by reading just a quotation from C.S. Lewis. He says, "It is hardly complimentary to God that we should choose Him as an alternative to hell. Yet even this he accepts. The creature's illusion of self-sufficiency must, for the creature's sake, be shattered. And by trouble or fear of trouble on earth, by crude fear of the eternal flames, God shatters it, unmindful of his glory's diminution. I call this divine humility, because it's a poor thing to strike our colors to God when the ship is going down under us. A poor thing to come to Him as a last resort to offer up our own when it's no longer worth keeping. If God were proud, He would hardly have us on such terms. But He's not proud. He stoops to conquer. He will have us even though we have shown that we prefer everything else to Him, and come to Him because there's nothing better now to be had."